Keegan with LibertarianProgressive.com. Today we're interviewing Larry Berlinski of the Constitution Party for the U.S. House of Representatives, District Number 3 in New Jersey, and he's the only third-party option in that district. I have a question for the audience before we start asking Larry some questions in this interview. The question is, who would you change them with? And the reason I'm asking that is because all the recent polls, from the Gallup poll and McClatchy and many other polls over the last 10 years, people are saying they would throw all of or elect all of Congress out. And if that's true, who would you replace them with? Would it be Larry or any of the other interviews we've done at LibertarianProgressive.com of independent third-party candidates who are on the ballot and the only third options in their specific district? Now, Larry's website is berlinskiforcongress.com, B-E-R-L-I-N-S-K-I-F-O-R, congress.com. And Larry, actually, I think you're the chairman of the Constitution Party in New Jersey.
That's correct.
You are the only alternate candidate on the ballot besides, you know, the status quo, meaning the Republicans and the Democrats. Is that true, sir?
That is correct. Initially, the Libertarian Party did put up a candidate. However, his petition was challenged by, I believe, and don't quote me on this, but I believe it was the Republican incumbent. And because he only had the minimum number of names, I guess he didn't put up much of a fight, and he got knocked off the ballot.
Well, actually, if there's a case to be made of making consensus, it might be a blessing in disguise, per se, because if you only have one third-party candidate, which is not every single district, most districts have a Green Party, Libertarian, you know, some other parties.
Right.
But in your specific district, if people really want to elect them out, you're the only option. And, you know, we found 50 such, actually about 70 such districts, but have interviewed about 50 such people like that around the entire country. What would
you
think?
Oh, you met your goal. That's great. I know you had a goal of
yes.
50 interviews. That's great to hear.
Well, we have 49 technically. So, yeah, I think we'll get the one more soon, and I appreciate that. And we might exceed that goal, but what kind of message would it send? We'll get into your platform and your issues in a moment, but
sure.
Even underlying all of that in the climate that we currently have, what kind of message would it send electing you as a Constitution member candidate to the Congress, and what kind of message would that send to New Jersey, but also to the United States and the powers that be, and to the voters?
Put quite simply, it'll send the message that people are fed up. You know, everybody says it's a two-party system, and I tend to disagree with that statement. I don't think it's a two-party system. I think it's a Republican-Democrat system. If it were truly a two-party system, Massachusetts, for instance, if you look at Massachusetts, the Republicans probably wouldn't have a chance there. It would be the Green Party versus the Democrats. Or if you look at, you know, a state like Utah, it would be the Republican Party versus the Constitution Party. And even if you say, okay, it's a two-party system, look what that does to the makeup of Congress. That's four different parties in Congress in a two-party system. So, but if you look at Congress now, it's just Republicans and Democrats. And right now, people are just so fed up with who those two major parties have nominated, that I think sending a third party to either Congress or the White House would send a strong message to both major parties that they need to fix themselves and start thinking about the American people instead of their own power.
I think that's true. And now let's separate the presidential branch from the Congress for just a moment, because I think the major argument against electing or voting for a third-party candidate for president may be slightly more strategically valid. Like if you live in a state that's completely blue, maybe you can take a risk of voting for a third party or vice versa. And people are afraid that if they cast a vote for their conscience, which might not be the Republican or Democrat, then it's more likely that the greater or the lesser of two evils might get in. Put all that aside, that might be true or false, but at the congressional level, I don't think that argument stands up nearly as much or even at all, because at the congressional level, I mean, you're going to be in a body of 435 people. There's much more of a buffer, plus it's just a two-year term, which was done on purpose. So,
no, I think,
you know,
you make
if there's
a valid
any place
point
to take that risk, it would be at Congress. Do you agree with
no,
that?
No, I think, yeah, no, I think you make a valid point, you know, as far as reaching the presidential level. As far as the congressional level, I would argue that, you know, even if one tried to make the lesser of two evil arguments, you know, let's say someone, you know, we'll use my for instance, the, you know, the Constitution Party, and I tend to be more what would be considered more conservative. People might be concerned that if I'm running here in a Republican district, that the Republicans might lose the House of Representatives. Well, my argument to that is, well, what the heck is the difference between the Republicans and the Democrats anyway? I mean, the Republican Party said that, hey, you know, give us the power in Congress and we'll stop, you know, the Obama administration from moving forward with its agenda. Well, they haven't done that. They have had the power in the House and the Senate for quite some time now, and they haven't even put up a token resistance to the administration. And so, what's the difference if the Republican wins or not? So voting a third party in the Congress, I think, would send a very strong message.
Yeah, I think the Republicans have rolled out their red carpets for Obama. They might argue in public, but, yeah, they're the red Republican carpet. So, Larry, tell us a little bit about your district. What are some of the cities that are in it, and, you know, just a little bit about your district, sir.
Well, our district was recently redistricted in the 2011 census. So if you look at a map of New Jersey, and you look at the East Coast, Brick Township would be the one of the most northern parts of the district, and then all the way down to Barnegat, along, you know, basically where the Garden State Parkway hugs the East Coast. And then the rest of the district, it kind of looks like an hourglass laid on its side with Highway 70 running right through the middle. And then over in Burlington County, you know, we have not quite Cherry Hill area, and definitely Mount Holly is at the center. Mount Holly is the county seat of Burlington. So those are some of the major parts. We have, you know, Toms River is a big town here. Manchester is not quite in the district. It's, like I said, the hourglass, the way they drew the district. But Forked River is another town. Forked River is used to be a small town. It has a nuclear power plant there. So, you know, it's a major contributor to the economy there. Those are some of the major towns.
Yeah, and if it's a conservative district, if someone's a lifelong Republican, actually the best thing that could happen to the Republican Party maybe could be argued that, you know, that someone or yourself is elected, that might make the Republican Party up their game, per se. And now, you are a family man, you have kids, you also were a veteran,
I am a veteran.
U.S. Navy submarine service.
Yes, sir.
And so you were in
the
submarines.
Yes. I proudly served the United States Navy from 1997 to 2003. Spent 4 years on the USS Nebraska, which is a ballistic missile submarine. Trained as a nuclear electrician. And I translated that into my civilian life. I work at the nuclear power plant that I mentioned earlier. I'm a senior reactor operator there. I graduated from Seton Hall University with a BA in political science. That was right before I enlisted in the Navy. So that's a little bit of background about myself. I met my wife right at the end of my naval career, like 2 weeks left. So I was very fortunate to have met her then. And then we got married, and several years later, now we have two beautiful children, 1 7, 1 4, two little girls. And they keep me on my toes, that's for sure.
Okay, and now let's just jump right into foreign policy, because, you know, that's where you could argue you have some experience and you have a veteran's background, and that is actually where most of our budget goes. That's where most of the time and effort is being placed since 9/11. And since then, there has been a new normal. And so, you know, how would what kind of, you know, if you got to Congress, you know, when you see proposals for like invading Syria, or how we deal with Russia, or how we deal with the Middle East, or how we deal with other countries in general, our world politics, friends, foes, alliances, etc. You know, let's say you have 2 years. You know, what are you going to bring to Congress, to the Capitol every day? What kind of mess are you going to bring, and what kind of coalitions are you going to try to build, and what's your approach?
Well, dealing specifically with foreign leaders, of course, is an executive branch duty, and of course, you know, treaties and ratification thereof, that's more of a senatorial thing. However, the one thing that the House of Representatives can do, you know, the Congress is the power of the purse, right? And only the Congress can declare war. Last time we declared war was 1941, and we've only done it 5 times in the history of the United States. Right now, we have generals saying that the United States Army can barely meet its commitments around the world. Now, if we haven't declared a war, what kind of commitments do we have that the Army is stretched to such an extreme? That means one of two things, if not both. It means, one, they're underfunded, and two, we have too many darn commitments. If we're going to send our friends, family, children in harm's way, we need to make damn sure that they're equipped properly, first of all, and second of all, that they have a clear mission when they go, and the means to do it. You know, we hamstring our troops with ridiculous rules of engagement that put them in harm's way. We limit, you know, a mission. The purpose of an army is to kill people and break things. And if we're sending them there to, you know, smile for the camera and be peacekeepers, they're there for the wrong reason. So that's a lot of money that we misappropriate, in my opinion. Now, as far as other branches, the Navy, you know, if you look at the Constitution, the Congress has the power to raise a Navy. It also has the power to raise an Army. But if you look at Article 1, Section 8, an Army is only supposed to be appropriated for 2 years at a time. Now, please don't misunderstand. I'm not suggesting that, you know, we drastically cut the Army. That's not my point. But my point is, if we're going to project power around the world, it's best done through the United States Navy. The Navy's, you know, the Navy has more airplanes than the Air Force. We have China building artificial islands in the South China Sea, threatening a major shipping lane. And I'm not suggesting that they would, you know, hold the world at gunpoint, but it's certainly a very strategic thing that they're doing, and we're not answering. We have now the Navy cutting rates. It used to be, if you were an electrician in the Navy, you were an electrician in the Navy. You're no longer an electrician. You do this thing, and you can sometimes do other things. So we're expending the role of a single person to do multiple roles, and I don't think that's particularly wise given the way the Navy is set up. Now, I certainly don't think that Congress can control the Navy, but I think this is a symptom of poor funding. in addition to a couple of other things, but poor funding certainly is one of them. And that's something that the Congress can change.
What about oversight? I recently saw an article made the headlines about the Department of Defense couldn't account for, like, I don't know, $6 trillion or something over the last couple of years. Do you think, and not just the Department of Defense, but should the Department of Defense get a thorough audit, and so should every department of the government?
Well, I don't think we should single out the Department of Defense in that regard. There's waste, fraud, and abuse, you know, across the board. So if we're going to do an audit, I certainly think that, you know, to do it to every major department and would be the more appropriate thing to do. Because, like I said, waste, fraud, and abuse is something that is unfortunately all too familiar at the federal government, and we certainly need to look into seeing what we could do to save the taxpayers some money.
Okay, and now a lot of, and this might sound more cynical, but why we have, you know, a military all across the world, some might argue is, you know, we want to protect shipping lanes and we want to prevent other people from filling the vacuum, per se. These are just arguments, and they're not necessarily my arguments, but
no,
and then also oil. We're addicted to oil, and we need that oil for our airplanes, for our ships, for et cetera. You know, are those valid arguments? Are there other ways we could get off our addiction to oil, especially from certain sources? And should we rethink our global strategy for the future, do you think?
I think a strategy change would be wise. As I said, we have these missions all over the world right now, and I'm certainly not suggesting that we immediately retract our army, because that would certainly cause a power void. And as we saw with Iraq, we were very successful there, and for whatever reason, we decided to just announce that we were going to pull out when we were going to pull out, and the instant we did, ISIS grew exponentially. So I think there is a difference between, you know, getting out and, you know, making a wise decision on the way in which we do it. So I do think that, you know, changing our mission around the world would be important. However, what is also just as important is how we go about making that transition to avoid making trouble, because it seems like every time we stick our nose in something, we just make the problem worse. And it's not necessarily because we have the boots on the ground. It's more about how we take the boots off of the ground.
Right, an exit strategy, I suppose. What about energy? Because that seems to be very important, you know, to the future, to the present. Are we addicted
right.
to oil? And if we are, how do we, you know, either supply that addiction or get unaddicted to it as much?
Well, I think a diversification of how and what we use is the way to go. I don't think it would have come to a surprise to you to say that I'm a proponent of nuclear power, being that I'm an employee at a nuclear power plant. You know, many countries around the world use nuclear energy as opposed to fossil fuels to, you know, to power themselves. I'm not opposed to what are called renewable sources. However, I don't think they're necessarily as environmentally friendly as some of their advocates are. And I certainly don't think that government subsidies is something that is a way to go. Moving forward into the future, there are certainly going to be technologies, I'm sure, that will be able to help in reducing our dependency on oil. I mean, obviously, you're not going to have a nuclear-powered car or a solar-powered car or anything like that. But, you know, generally speaking, diversification in the consumption is a good way to go. And as far as getting off of oil, I don't have the expertise to know what's on the horizon as far as, you know, what can we use as opposed to oil. However, I do know we're in the oil age now. We didn't get out of the stone age because we ran out of stones. So I'm sure there's going to be something in the future, and it would be worth, you know, certainly exploring that.
Sure. And I guess what I was trying to get at is, and I did see on your website, you're not for subsidizing, any kind of energy, and that includes oil and gas as well as
Absolutely. Solar
and other things. So you're even across the board, don't subsidize any of them. And so have a level playing field of free markets.
No, absolutely not. If you look at Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, again, it's a list of things that, you know, the Congress can do. And that's it. Because if you look at the 10th Amendment, it says that if it's not listed here, then the Congress can't do it, or the rest of the federal government can't do it. That kind of thing would be left up to the states. For instance, if New Jersey decided that it was going to fund some type of research for some type of alternate energy, that's certainly fine. And then it doesn't affect every state. It doesn't affect the taxpayers in Utah and Nebraska and California. It's the taxpayers of New Jersey. And if the taxpayers in New Jersey don't want to fund it, well, then they can vote the guys out that they had in Trenton. And they don't have to rely on, you know, worrying about national politics and get rid of the guy in Congress. They can just take care of it at home. And that's, you know, where the power, you know, should be, closer to home.
Sure. And especially when it comes to energy, since the U.S. is such a big area, I mean, places like Florida and Arizona might really like to look into solar, while some other places like Chicago might, I don't know, I guess maybe like wind or something. But and the free market might be the best way to get us off of oil. I mean, we might just as well purchase oil from the Middle East or South America or any other place in the world using the free market, and it might, you know, the prices might not go up like we might fear if we were just able to purchase it and through competition. But let's go into the Second Amendment. I mean, we're just originally talking about defending our country, but what about just at the, and this might also pertain to defending the country, but also defending your own self as an individual. There's been, I guess the talk lately is we need to put restrictions. If you're going to be on the no-fly list, then you can't buy a gun. And so what do you think about when you hear Hillary Clinton and even Donald Trump a little bit, you know, advocating that?
It's difficult to say, because who defines, you know, what's it mean to be on the no-fly list, right?
Right.
So if you're a citizen of the United States, you have a right to defend your family, your property, and yourself with a firearm. And just because some regulatory agency decides that you shouldn't fly for some reason or another, without due process, I don't see how your right can be taken away. It's not like I have to go ask permission to, you know, step on a soapbox in the park just because, you know, I had a bad locker room conversation that was recorded accidentally, shall we say. And I know it's a difficult situation, and a lot of people have very, you know, strong arguments on both sides. But the way I see it, it is my God-given right to be able to protect my family and myself and my property. And until due process of law takes that away from me because I have proven myself to be unfit to do so, it's just not something that should be done.
Yeah, so maybe the key term there is due process, because due process means, you know, knowing the evidence that's against you, knowing the accuser, having a jury of your peers, a speedy and fair trial, and probably other things I can't think of right now, but those are all major planks of, you know, what's known as due process. And so maybe the inter no fly list should be looked at. I mean, I'm not saying there shouldn't be people that the FBI is not watching, but I mean, by putting them on a no fly list, number one, that might tip people off that they're on a no fly list. But number two, the FBI have been watching people, and sometimes their superiors don't listen to people further down on the chain when they suspect someone of doing something suspicious, and so they don't follow up with it properly. And number three, I mean, it's almost like, you know, you're being punished before any trial. I mean, so it just seems like it cuts out the whole due process.
That's not it seems like. That's exactly what it is. They are taking your rights away from you without telling you why, without being able to face your accuser, and without being tried.
Yeah, and under the cover of trying to get rid of gun violence, they're normalizing it. I mean, because that can also set a precedent for other kinds of lists in the future and things like that. I mean, you know, we have the Bill of Rights.
And that's the key right there. And it's not so much, and that touches on so many topics, not just gun rights. If you allow the federal government to do something, it's not about the people that are there now and whether or not they're going to do it for good or for bad. It's about you just let the federal government do something, and now you've set a precedent. So at some point in the future, maybe a different group of people are in there, maybe people that you don't like, maybe people that you don't trust, but you've already given them the ability to do that. And that's what's truly dangerous, and that's why we need to safeguard our rights and assert the Constitution and make sure that it's part of everyday dialogue.
All right, very good. And just a quick question about, there's states like Colorado, Oregon, Washington, to name a few, that are having initiative referendums to legalize cannabis, otherwise known as marijuana. Should the federal government try to stop them, or should they be allowed to continue their experiment? You know, should the DEA step in or not step in to those states?
Well, I don't see anywhere in the Constitution where the federal government can limit that. They tried once with alcohol, and then that was repealed, and that was in the Constitution. I do believe that it is a states' rights issue. I do believe that there is a drug problem here in the United States. Whether or not marijuana is part of the drug problem is certainly a whole can of worms that we can open up and probably talk for another hour about. But I don't think that the federal government should have a law, which it currently does, to limit that. I know that they're not enforcing that law right now, and that could change on a dime with a new administration. I don't know that either one of the major party candidates is for or against continuing the current policy. However, that is the federal law right now. And, you know, for those people who are in Colorado and other such states, just be careful, because a new administration could come in, they could decide that they want to enforce the law now, and all of a sudden you're on the wrong side of the law again.
Yeah, that's... What about the Trans-Pacific Partnership? For those people who don't know, it's kind of like NAFTA, another trade deal where it's, instead of just making an agreement with one country and the United States, it's you know, a big trade deal with like 20 countries at a time. Some people say it takes away sovereignty, although you know, you might like free trade. What do you think about the TPP, otherwise known as Trans-Pacific Partnership?
Well, I don't think the way it is written is a good idea. Now, here in the United States, we only have available to us 27 of the 30 chapters of it. You have to go through a foreign country if you want to get the other three chapters, which baffles me and kind of scares me, first off. Second of all, if you're going to have a free trade agreement, and I am a free market capitalist, if we're going to have a free trade agreement, it should be between one country and the United States. I do not believe in entangling treaties with multiple countries that take away, you know, our sovereignty or limit what we can do. Just to answer your question in a simple term, no, I'm against the TPP as written.
There shouldn't be a law against it per se, but there's a lot of bills, especially the big ones like the Affordable Care Act, which, you know, I clearly suppose you're against that. But there's a lot of laws that are like 2,000 pages, 3,000 pages, 4,000 pages, et cetera.
Right.
I mean, is that a problem? Should we have a law against that, or do we just need to get off our couches and just elect people that are going to introduce legislation that's a lot more simple?
Well, that's the rub, isn't it? How do you make a law limiting the amount of law or the size of a law? I think the intent of the Founding Fathers was that those who make laws are supposed to be common everyday people, and they're supposed to write laws for common everyday people. And from there, it's left to the courts to interpret the law. To have such an onerous or such a large bill that nobody but a lawyer with a slide rule and an abacus can understand, how are you supposed to follow the law if you don't understand it? There are several instances, I'm sure, that people are violating the law and they don't even know it. And that's a dangerous place to be, because now all of a sudden, you know, you're in violation of something that you didn't know. And they always say ignorance is no excuse. So now you're fined or you're imprisoned and you don't even know why. And then they'll say, well, here's the law right here. And, if laws were simpler, maybe there would be less of them. And, you know, everyone always says, well, you got to be a lawyer before you go into politics. Well, I think the problem is you send lawyers to politics, and this is what you get. To me, it seems like it's a conflict of interest. You can't have a lawyer writing the laws if they're the ones that are going to be executing and prosecuting the laws.
That's an interesting way to put it. And speaking of conflicts of interest, and this is kind of in a similar principle, you know, we have people that the last couple secretaries of the Treasury, I think, have worked for Goldman Sachs. Last, person that was the head of the FDA worked for Monsanto. I mean, in other pharmaceutical companies, there's lots of conflicts of interest, the revolving door per se, lots of lobbyists. And I mean, should there be some kind of rule against that? Should we also have term limits? Or are these just other things where people just need to get off their couch and the true accountability is the people themselves? Or should there be some laws that, influence that behavior as well?
Well, the president can appoint, whomever they like, with the consent of the Senate, people to cabinet positions. And in a general sense, I don't think it's unreasonable to have somebody who is familiar with, say drug companies, to be head of the FDA. I mean, as the president of the United States, if I were going to be president of the United States, I wouldn't know, the ins and outs of the industry and what would be best for them. So I would certainly want somebody who from that realm that would know a little bit better and can advise me better, in that respect. But you asked about term limits. I don't think that term limits is the way to go, particularly with Congress. That would, first of all, require a constitutional amendment, which is a difficult burden to pass. My proposal is completely different. I say we end pensions for members of Congress. You know, right now, if you serve 5 years, then you have a pension. Well, that's one term for a senator, and it's only, you know, two re-elections for a congressman. I think if you're going to serve your country in the Congress, it should be a sacrifice. You're sacrificing some time for your country. It should be a sacrifice, not an opportunity for a golden parachute. So if you get rid of pensions for Congress, which would only require a stroke of a pen, and I'm sure it would be very difficult to pass that legislation, but if you were to get rid of pensions, I submit that there would not be lifetime politicians in Congress, because they would have to go out and live amongst the people and be subject to the laws that they passed. Now, they're not. They just sit in Congress for 20, 30, 40 years and on the taxpayer dime.
All right. And now, what about taxes? Should we get rid of the IRS?
I don't think, philosophically speaking, yes. Practically speaking, I don't think it can be done real quick. You can't just rip off the Band-Aid. I do think a simplification of the tax code is in order. I think it's ridiculous that somebody that's rich can pay some accountant and find all the loopholes, and I think it's ridiculous that somebody that's, you know, in the middle class gets, and I hate to use that term because it appears in the Communist Manifesto, but you have to use the lexicon. Somebody who makes, you know, somewhere in the middle, they don't necessarily have the means to hire, you know, an accountant to be able to figure it out. I say if you have a simple flat tax, you know, even if you just say, you know, after the first $30,000 or $40,000 of income, and after that, any income you make, flat 15%. That's it. It'd be a lot simpler. You'd actually collect more money, and it would be a lot more fair.
Okay. And now, speaking about sovereignty, and this might be on the topic or not, but recently, do you hear about, you know, when people register their internet domains? We just recently handed that database, or the group that handles all website domain registration. So, like, I own libertarianprogressive.com, and you own...
That's a great name, by the way. I like that.
Thank you very much. And you own berlinskyforcongress.com. And now, usually I register that with my internet service provider, who actually also registers that with, like, ICANN or some nonprofit internet organization. And they handle, you know, I have to pay every couple of years to keep that domain, and they handle all that. And that was based in the U.S. Now it has been turned over to the U.N. What do you think about freedoms in general, that decision specifically, and our overall sovereignty in the world today?
Well, I'm not very familiar with the turnover of the internet to a UN council. However, I will say this about the UN. I think it's bad for the United States. I think it's bad for U.S. sovereignty. I think it's bad for world policy. The UN has proven itself to be an inept organization, causing more problems than solving problems. And I'm not a fan of it. As far as the internet in and of itself, I don't see why it should be controlled by any entity other than the private industry. I'm afraid of government control of anything. Or at least, you know, very skeptical of it at best. Just based on what you told me and the limited information I have of it, it doesn't sound like something that I'd be in favor of.
Sure, and that's kind of new news. I mean, I think that just broke in pretty much in the mainstream news just a few weeks ago, so it has not received a lot of headlines. So that's fair enough. But all right, let's see. You have here immigration. Now, you know, now the Statue of Liberty says, give me your humbled masses or something like that, your poor, et cetera. What's wrong with our immigration policy nowadays, and how would you like to see it change to make it fair and, you know, prosperous and peaceful?
Well, I think what's wrong with our immigration policy right now is it's not being enforced. You know, if you look at our laws, they're not too bad. Unfortunately, we're giving a lot of people a pass, and we have open borders. I think if you were to remove federal benefits for those who are here illegally, that would go a long way in, you know, not only deterring people from coming here, but also encouraging self-deportation. As far as, you know, we have somewhat of a catch and release policy when it comes to finding illegal immigrants, and the thing that frustrates me the most about, you know, this topic is, you know, people tend to equate my position with being anti-immigrant. I'm certainly not anti-immigrant. I think immigrants have what made this country not only as interesting, but as good as it is. You know, we take the best that the world has to offer. You know.
Sure, and we want to clarify that.
And a lot of people say, well, you're anti-immigrant. No, I'm not anti-immigrant, and I'm certainly, well, then you must be anti-Mexican. Well, no, I'm not anti-Mexican. I want people who come here to want to be here to make our country better, in addition to making themselves better, not just coming here just to make themselves better. You know.
Let me ask you some follow-up questions about that. Let me let you finish your thought there, but I just have like three follow-up questions specifically about that to help clarify. Well, I mean, so you're not talking about going door-to-door to people's houses, right?
I think initially that doesn't seem to be a good plan. That would cost an awful lot of money. However, you know, there are many people that are here illegally that got here legally in the first place, something like 40%, you know, and who knows, because, you know, I don't know how we can count them, but something like 40% of the people that are here illegally have just overstayed their visas. Well, we need to find these people and make sure that they get out, you know, if we can. Any time that we come across them via the legal system, we need to, you know, hey, we found one for free, let's get rid of them, you know, that kind of thing. As far as going door to door, no, I think that would be very difficult to do. In the short term, going door to door to finding out who these people are, there are plenty that we can find without doing that, and we can put a big dent in the issue right there.
Right, and you're not talking about ending like student visas or
no, absolutely
people
not
coming here for tourism or things
not
like that.
No, I want people to come here and see how great this country is and can be, and go home and tell their friends. You know, right now the United States doesn't seem to have a good reputation around the world, and I'd like that to change, but I don't want it to change at the cost of, you know, our freedoms and liberties and you know, at the cost of unnecessary spending on taxpayer dollars. So
basically you're saying just enforce the existing laws.
Existing laws and limit, you know, those coming here legally.
Okay. And I mean, that's, you know, we already have existing laws, so if someone's criticizing you, they're just criticizing really the existing laws. Let's talk about the criminal justice system a little bit. This might not be so much on the congressional level, but do you think, but it has been in the news lately, and just to, you know, the Black Lives Matter, you know, or Black Lives Matter too. Do you think there is a problem in the criminal justice system regarding racial profiling or, you know, some minorities being, you know, picked on, I guess, or unjustly treated under the law?
The statistics don't say so. I think right now the black community is being exploited again by somebody with an agenda. And what's happening is the news that is being broadcast is skewed in the direction of, you know, to fit that narrative, and that the black, like I said, the black community is being exploited to continue to balkanize the people of the United States. I think if, you know, we keep fighting amongst each other and against each other, we're not paying attention to what's going on in Washington, D.C. or the State House over in Trenton, and those people get to broker their power while we fight amongst ourselves.
So you definitely want us to stop fighting amongst ourselves, kind of united we stand, divided we fall.
We need to stop thinking of ourselves as something Americans and start realizing that we are Americans. And, you know, we have, or you know, I'm from New Jersey. We identify with that. You know, I'm sure people in, you know, California identify with being from California. Why does it have to be, well, I identify with only with people of the color of my skin? It seems ridiculous to me.
Yeah, well, we're the first country really to be formed based on principles, actually, instead of just a tribe, per se. What about, now, this might just go into another states' rights issue, but fracking, if certain states want to ban it, I mean, you don't see any problem with that. Should that pretty much be handled at the state level, do you think?
I think if a state thinks that fracking is not something that's beneficial to them for one reason or another, then that's, you know, certainly their right to ban the practice in that state.
Okay, and now let's get into the economy a little bit. But small, mid-sized businesses, I don't know what you would think, you know, the federal government could do to help nurture a good environment for small businesses. Mid-sized businesses the way it is now. I mean, we do see entrepreneurship going down. Maybe our monetary policy might have something that contributes to it a little bit. But,
well, I think
the
best thing that the federal government can do to help small businesses is to get the hell out of the way. We have all these overbearing regulatory agencies that make regulations. They do not make law, because it says in the first line of the Constitution, all legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress of the United States, which is made up of the House and the Senate. And now we have regulatory agencies, and I'm going to pick on the EPA, you know, some bureaucrat who's sitting in an unelected position in an office decides that, I don't like the way this is, and now I'm going to impose a fine or jail time on somebody who does this. Well, that guy wasn't elected, and now if I violate that regulation, I'm going to jail or I'm going to be fined. Well, who the heck is that guy? I didn't vote for him. And then if I complain to my congressman, he has cover. Congress has given up their right and their duty to make law, and they are not allowed to do that. So we have all these regulatory agencies making what are basically de facto laws, and people go to jail and people get fined, you know, and they have no recourse. So
that's true. There's
not
a lot
only
of
that,
unelected bureaucrats.
Right. So, you know, we say we live in a representative republic. Well, show me the evidence of that. So, you know, what the federal government can do is rein in these federal regulatory agencies. If a state wants to have a department of EPA, and I know New Jersey does, that's great. And that pertains to New Jersey. Why do we need the federal EPA? We don't. So, you know, what can the federal government do to make, you know, a good economic environment for small business? Well, that's one thing. Another thing they could do is stop bailing out all these big businesses. We talk a lot of, you know, conservatives talk a lot about ending welfare. Well, I'm all about ending corporate welfare too. Why did the United States government bail out GM? Why did the United States government bail out Chrysler? The people voted with their dollars that those companies should fail. Didn't like the product. They thought the product was too expensive for what they were willing to pay. And they voted with their dollars to not purchase those cars. But the federal government said, no, we're going to take the tax money that you gave us and we're going to give it to these companies anyway. So these people ended up buying Chryslers and GMs when they didn't want to buy them. They bypassed the whole idea of a free market capitalist system. As much as I'm against welfare, I'm against crony capitalism. That is not, and a lot of people confuse that with capitalism. And that's where Republicans get in a lot of trouble. And that's one of the reasons why I left the Republican Party. They do not understand free market capitalism. They think it's supporting big business. It's not. Free market capitalism means letting big businesses fail. And that's good for an economy. Not maybe in the short term for the worker, but in the long run for most people, that's the best thing. Because it, you know, it's like if the car company failed, it's not like all that stuff disappears. We may have had two or three smaller car companies that would have bought up the equipment that used to be Chrysler and GM, and they would have made perhaps better cars, perhaps worse cars, but the free market could have decided that. But now we'll never know because we had to buy Chrysler and GM.
Larry, I think you're absolutely right in that. I mean, most people were against the bailouts in 2008, yet Congress decided to vote, you know, for them anyways. And if you have these companies and these CEOs are the head of these companies that are, I guess you could call them incompetent, since they, you know, ran them to the ground, and then they come asking the government to be bailed out, and they do get bailed out. I mean, what does it say to the market, to the competition? If let's say you were mid-sized, you know, you just lost your opportunity to maybe buy that bigger bank that had failed, and instead of having this new mid-sized bank that would have bought out parts of these, you know, too big to fail banks. With better management, you know, these mid-sized banks that didn't need the bailouts, now you would have had CEOs and people that were more fiscally responsible taking the helms, but instead you're just rewarding the same people. I mean, if you did that in any other way in life, I mean, if you had a baseball team and if you had a catcher who kept on, you know, letting the person get into home plate and you keep giving them a raise and, you know, you're just going to have a losing team. And so we're rewarding incompetency. Now, you did say on your website that you're against raising the minimum wage, but you are for, you know, there's no laws needed for people to assemble freely and unionize. And that kind of reminds me of the situation in Denmark, actually. Believe it or not, people say like they have a higher standard of living and for, you know, low end workers and stuff. But I looked into it. They don't even have a minimum wage in that country, but what they do have is a strong union. And, and just because of that union, the workers at McDonald's get paid more. The Big Macs don't cost really that much more. And it's just all with, voluntary unions and, and they don't even need a minimum wage there.
Well, like I said on my website, you don't need a law to, you know, improve union relations. People have the right to assemble, and a company has the right to or not to negotiate with that union. But that's a private business matter. That should not involve the government at all.
Now, I just have two more questions for you, Larry. What do you think it is about freedom that people have forgotten today? What do you think that is? Have we forgotten as a society in general what freedom
means? I think that we forgot that it's something that needs to be closely guarded. People are very willing to give up their freedoms just to feel a little bit safer. When in fact, you know, if I can remember the quote from Ben Franklin, you know, those who give up a little bit of freedom for a little bit of safety deserve neither and lose both. The Patriot Act, for instance, you know, that was something that Oh, yeah, that's a good idea. We got to get these terrorists. Well, you know, if you read the Fourth Amendment, the Patriot Act is a very, very clear violation of the Fourth Amendment of the United States. And it was all done under the guise of, well, we're going to make ourselves safe from these terrorists. Well, I don't feel any safer right now. I don't think that anything that the Patriot Act has yielded made us any safer. You know, we spend a lot of money on, you know, we have this new Department of Homeland Security, and you have to go through a very intimate exam just to get on an airplane. We spend all this money on the security, and are we any safer? No. Just a few weeks ago, you know, I live at the Jersey Shore. Just a few weeks ago, there was a bomb placed in a garbage can that was, you know, it was set to go off when a bunch of veterans, they were having a 5K, and it was set to go off when they were just about to be right there, and by an act of God, there was a delay in the start of the race. And then the same individual was, you know, caught in actually the town I grew up in, Linden, New Jersey, and he had placed two bombs on a New Jersey Transit, you know, train. Well, all these things didn't stop that guy. So, you know, unfortunately, the fact of the matter is we live in a dangerous world. We need to accept that fact, and we need to be prepared to, you know, defend ourselves. You know, if something is happening right here, right now, I don't want to have to pick up the phone, dial 911, and wait for a cop to get here. Cops can't be everywhere all the time, nor should they have to be, and nor should they be at all. It is your right, it is your duty as a free human being to defend yourself and your family and your property, as I said earlier. So, you know, that the thing that we forget about freedom is that it's dangerous. But, you know, that's the trade-off, right? If you can be perfectly safe if you go to jail. You get three hots and a cot and a roof over your head, you know. But you're living in prison. If you want to be free, it's a dangerous world, and you have to accept that as reality.
That's a good point. I mean, so our freedom is our greatest strength. It could also at some times be our greatest vulnerability. But overall, I mean, if it wasn't for our freedom, you know, people like Albert Einstein wouldn't have, you know, came here. They probably would have came to someplace else. And we wouldn't have the spirit and the environment of the business that we've had and stuff like that. So without the freedom, we probably wouldn't even be a place worth fighting for. And so who are some of your favorite people, past or present, Larry?
Some of my favorite people, past or present. You're talking about, you know, people that everyone would know kind of people?
I just want you to answer that how you feel like answering.
Well, since I assume I'm speaking to an audience, I'll stay away from my close personal heroes, you know, within my family. People who have influenced me, I would say, in my way of thinking, you know, to get where I am. Initially, I have to admit, I listened to Rush Limbaugh early on. Probably started my senior year of high school, and we're talking, you know, 1992, 1993 time frame. I listened to him for quite some time, and he helped shape my philosophies, along with other local radio hosts like Bob Grant, people like that. Moving forward, you know, after I joined the Navy, I started doing well. I did a lot of reading even before then. I've, you know, read the Federalist Papers. I like to read a lot of history. Some of the things that the founders did, you know, Franklin and Washington and Jefferson Adams, particularly Madison, is a fantastic figure. Mark Levin is somebody that I've been listening to a lot recently. He would not necessarily agree with the fact that I've left the Republican Party, but I enjoy listening to him. He sometimes is a little aggressive in the way he speaks, but if you can get past that, he does get into a lot of the philosophy, and I certainly enjoy that. You know, he gets into Montesquieu and de Tocqueville and all that. So those are the people that have helped shape my political philosophies and ways of thinking.
Well, so we're talking to someone here that whatever you believe as far as being a Democrat, Republican, Independent, I mean, you would have voted against the bailouts, it sounds like. You would have voted in protection of the Fourth Amendment and the Constitution. And you might not get everything that you want to pass in 2 years if you are elected, but you are on the ballot giving people an option. And it actually, it might up the games of the other parties in the long term. So, I mean,
I like to think
have you
so.
Been in any debates yet? Are there any debates coming up?
No. Tom MacArthur, the Republican incumbent, did not want to debate with me on the stage. The Democrat, my Democrat opponent, Fred Laverne, he insisted that I be on the stage with them if there were to be a debate. So there was no debate. However, yesterday the three of us met for an interview at the Asbury Park Press, which is the paper in basically South Jersey. So, you know, there's a little snippet on their website if you're interested. But no, there hasn't been a debate, unfortunately.
Have you considered publicly challenge, or maybe you have already, the Republican? And good, I guess good for that Democrat for, you know, standing up for principle of an open and fair debate.
No, over the course of the campaign, Fred and I have spoken frequently. I like him personally. We certainly don't agree on some issues, but he's a fascinating individual. Encyclopedic in knowledge. He's very knowledgeable in a lot of things. So I do have a lot of respect for my Democrat opponent. I don't know Tom MacArthur, so I cannot say neither good nor bad about him.
Sure, but if I was a voter and, you know, one candidate was spoiling the entire debate process,
well,
you know,
mean,
it's
you,
almost
you,
like...
Yeah. Yeah, on one hand, he is, but on the other hand, yeah, you have to look at strategically. It doesn't benefit him as the incumbent to let a third party guy get in there, especially one that's conservative and would, in theory, take votes away. So, I mean, I certainly understand the strategy behind it. Really, it's his to lose at that point, you know. So, I don't really begrudge him that. I'm a little disappointed, but I don't begrudge him that. I certainly understand strategy and why he's doing what he's doing. So
I hear you, Larry, but that's the main point. It doesn't benefit him, and he's there to represent the district, who
exactly
is, you know, trying to benefit the district. So people can find out more at BerlinskiForCongress.com, BerlinskiForCongress.com. And
I do have a Facebook page. The Facebook page has the same name, and it is updated more frequently than the website. The website's more difficult to update. I do make posts. So please find me on Facebook as well.
Yeah, one final question, Larry. Let's say you were the incumbent, and 2 years from now, you know, you had an up-and-coming challenger like a Republican that wanted to debate. But let's say you were kind of popular and people liked you after 2 years, and it would be
right,
probably to your best interest not to debate them. Would you do the same strategy, or would you go ahead and debate your opponents if they were on the ballot?
I think it'd be easy for me to say, you know, obviously that I would. You know, just based on the answer I gave previously, I like to think that I would debate, and I'd like to think that I would keep in mind that I'm here to serve the people of the 3rd District of New Jersey. So, you know, I'll leave it at I would like to think, you know, given that it's a hypothetical.
Sure.
And that's about as far as I can go with that one, I suppose.
All right. Well, we do thank you for the honest answer. And so we do wish you good luck in your campaign. And any final words of wisdom, Larry?
No, I'd just like to thank you for the opportunity to speak with you and your audience. You know, just remember that, you know, the Constitution really, it's cliche, the Constitution is the solution. If you just open it and read it, it's not a very long document, you know. And even to somebody who's new to it, you know, I recommend reading the articles backwards. And I don't mean word for word. I mean, you know, read the last article first. It's a lot easier to read that way. You don't get bogged down in some of the nuance of the Article 1. And to those who are listening that are in the Tea Party movement, you know, they fly the Gadsden flag, don't tread on me. And I'd like to ask them, now that you've been tread upon, will you bite?
We'll find out November 8th, and there's a real option here in Congress, New Jersey's District Number 3. So, you know, if you're in a district where you don't have a third option and you're one of those 70% of people that would elect them all out, you know, maybe give Larry here a hand. Well, Larry, good to talk to you today. I hope you have a great night, and thanks for the time today, sir.
All right. Thanks, Tom, very much.